I will call the April 2nd, 2025 meeting of the House Public Safety Committee to order. The quorum is present. Before we begin our meeting, I want to remind everyone that the committee expects proper decorum at all time. All dialogue goes through the chair. Signs are not allowed in the committee room. There will be no outburst or clapping. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in the walkways and aisles is prohibited. If accommodation is needed, communicate with the sergeant staff. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in removal from the hearing room. Thank you to the Sergeant at Arms staff who are present for helping maintain decorum in the committee room. Representative Feist, I can always count on you to have reviewed the minutes. But this month, or today, I'm going to go to Representative Duran. Have you had a chance to review the meetings, minutes of the April 1st, 2025 meeting?
I have, and move them.
Representative Duran moves approval of the April 1st, 2025 minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye. All opposed say nay. Motion carries and the minutes of the April 1st, 2025 meeting are approved. Much like yesterday, we have a full agenda. We are asking all testifiers to be succinct and to the point. Testifiers from the public will have a maximum of 1.5 minutes to provide testimony. The first bill on the agenda today is House File 538. Representative Steer, I see you're at the testifier table with your testifier. Representative Steer, would you like to move your bill before the committee with the recommendation that House File 538 is referred to the General Register?
That is my motion, and I do have an amendment.
Thank you. We heard this bill on March 4th and had public testimony at that time. There will be no additional public testimony. Representative Steer, please remind the committee of what your bill does.
All right. House File 538 is in front of us again. It's a use of deadly force statute, and we're changing in the amendment, page 1, line 10, after 2. Do I got to start over?
No. Go ahead.
All right. So after 2, insert or perceived by. And I want to thank Chair Moeller for all her hard work behind the scenes working with the Chiefs of Police Association and MPPOA. Without her help on this, we wouldn't be where we are today. So I'll pass it off to the testifier here, Imran Ali.
Mr. Ali, state your full name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Imran Ali. I am the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association General Counsel. Good afternoon. Officers in Minnesota need consistency in the law and the application of that law in our 87 counties. Our community also needs transparency to ensure that the law is applied uniformly all across the state. I want to thank Representative Steer for bringing this bill, this important bill, forward, and also to Chair Novotny and to Chair Moeller for their hard work on this bill. One of the blessings of my job at MPPOA is representing over 10,000 members of law enforcement. I get to speak with police officers every single day from all corners of our state, and I hear from them loud and clear that this statute, 609-066, that was amended, needs to now comport with our laws and the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision in Graham versus Connor. With this amendment, we make our officers and our communities safer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ali. And Mr. You were speaking to the A2 amendment. Representative Steer, you would like to move the A2 amendment?
That is my motion.
Does anyone have any questions on the A2 amendment? Representative, or Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to put on the record, appreciated the opportunity to press pause to work on this, and just want to make it clear that the language in the A2 amendment matches what's already in statute with the legislative intent. You don't see that in the bill because it's only starting at subdivision 2, but subdivision 1A of section 609-066 says that should be evaluated from the perspective of a reasonable officer in the same situation based on the totality of the circumstances known to or perceived by the officer at that time without rather than with the benefit of hindsight. And so I just wanted to be clear that the language in the amendment is mimicking the intent, and it's at least our intent in doing that, that this isn't necessarily changing anything, it's just providing clarity. I know courts will do what courts are gonna do, but just wanted to make sure that that legislative intent is placed on the record. And again, thank you for the opportunity to work on this. Thank you.
Okay, is there any other questions to the A2 amendment? All in favor of the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion carries and the A2 amendment is adopted. Any closing questions before Representative Steer goes to closing comments? Representative Steer, closing comments.
I just want to thank again Chair Mueller and this entire committee for taking a look at this. This will impact every police officer across the state of Minnesota. It will make our community safer. So again, thank you.
Representative Steer renews his motion that House File 538, as amended, is recommended to be referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion carries and House File 538, as amended, is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Steer and Testifier Ali. Next bill coming on our agenda is House File 285. Representative Hudson, please come to the table with your testifier. 2825. Representative Hudson, would you like to move House File 2825 before the committee with a recommendation it is re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Please explain your bill and have your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and Chair Mueller as well. This bill, House File 2825, would provide the ability of private security agencies and public detectives or private detectives to, when they are bringing new staff on to their agencies, to be able to open records of expungement as part of a criminal background check. This is something that is already possible for law enforcement agencies, and the rationale is similar. We're bestowing a high level of trust upon folks to engage in these jobs where they have virtually unlimited access to facilities and personnel and are tasked with duties and responsibilities that require a high degree of character and the ability of these organizations, when they're bringing people on, to entrust them to fulfill the contracts that they have with their clients, properly ought to be able to take into consideration their full criminal record. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you. First time testifier is Richard Hodson. Please begin your testimony. State your full name.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Richard Hodson, H-O-D-S-D-O-N. I currently am a public member, and I have chaired for several years the board that licenses private detectives and private security in Minnesota. As the representative indicated, what we are simply asking this legislature to do is put the private security and private detective licensing system and the license holders, when it comes to criminal history background check for convictions, I want to emphasize conviction, to put them on the same plane, the same level as this legislature has already authorized for law enforcement, criminal justice employees, and those people who run licensed daycare centers. We are not proposing to change at all who is or is not legally eligible to work in private security or obtain a license, but what we need to do is be able to find those people. And under the current law, that's not possible because the exceptions that allow access to expunged records. And in Minnesota, our courts have said an expungement doesn't set aside a conviction. A disqualifying conviction is still a conviction under Chapter 609A. We are simply trying to find them because we've already had individuals who have applied for licenses, for example, who have gun crime convictions, who have felony theft convictions, and since the legislature has already decided those people do not belong protecting our families, our property, our public venues, we want to make sure that we fulfill that legislative function. The language is virtually with just a few words change straight out of the law that already exists for licensed peace officers. In the legal business, plagiarism is considered a high form of flattery. We plagiarized. And with that, I'm open for any questions. I do have with me as well the executive director of our organization, Greg Cook, if you need any substantive testimony on operational aspects. And by the way, the good news is this is revenue or cost zero. It costs nothing to allow us to promote public safety.
Mr. Cook, state your full name, begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Greg Cook, and I'm the executive director of the Board of Private Detectives and Protective Agents. As we work at the direction of the board, and the board has voted unanimously to support this bill, I would like to provide you with our agency's perspective. It is my job to manage the agency that provides the board information so they can make decisions. In this case, the information would be the results from background investigations done on applicants, license holders during renewals, as well as their employees when related to various violations. On the security side of things, these are entities that are responsible for protecting people, property, and assets. On the private investigation side, these entities are obtaining sensitive and personal information. Some of these people carry guns. Therefore, it is imperative that our agency does its due diligence for the people of Minnesota in ensuring that these entities are not only qualified, but do not have anything in their past history that may indicate a possible risk. For example, if you have someone who wants to become a protective agent, and in their history it shows various types of assault, disorderly conduct, firearms violations, or other violent crimes, they might not be the best person to handle a contentious situation. If you have somebody who's been charged with theft, they might not be the best person to protect somebody's assets. If you have someone who is involved in identity theft, credit card fraud, or financial crimes, they might not be the best person to obtain sensitive information. The other aspect of this is, if I was the owner of a security company or a private investigation firm, and I was going to hire somebody, I would also like to see the complete history of the person I was hiring, because I am responsible and liable for their actions. My understanding is there is already laws allowing full criminal history access to other professions. I believe that this industry needs the same, if not more, ability to properly credential people in our industry. Thank you.
Thank you. And before we move on, we have Representative Hudson, you have an amendment, A1. Would you like to speak to the amendment?
Yes, the amendment A1 merely corrects some language or inserts some language that ensures that this applies to private detectives as well.
This narrows the scope of the bill down to private detectives.
In addition to the security that it already references.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on the A1 amendment? All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. A1 amendment passes. Questions for Representative Hudson on the bill as amended? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Could you walk me through just a little bit of what the current process is for the background checks and what's possibly getting missed and what this change would actually entail?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the check is driven, let's say someone wants to apply to be a private detective or own a start a private security company. They have to submit an application. When they do that, they have to put a biometric-driven fingerprint cards. They are processed then. The BCA runs that check. In some circumstances, they also have access and can run an FBI check. When that comes back, the legislature has, by statute, determined certain crimes that are disqualifiers, like gun crimes, like felonies, like assaultive behavior. Based on that either lack of a record or a record, if a person has a record, then by statute, we could not legally give them a license even if we wanted to. And so that's how the background check is currently being used. Of course, luckily, a vast majority of people pass the background check with flying colors. For employees, they must do the same similar approach. If I own a private security company, I'm going to hire armed guards to transport money. They also are subject to a fingerprint-based check looking for the same exact disqualifying offenses. And if they are disqualified, then I'm not allowed to hire them. If they are qualified, then I can go ahead and hire them. And I emphasize, we are talking about conviction records, and this bill only addresses conviction records. We know people get arrested, and you know, doesn't mean that they did it. It hasn't been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. We've been very circumspect here, seeking only to apply this criteria for those who have been found by a judge beyond a reasonable doubt to have committed the offense.
Thank you, Mr. Hudson. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Just one more quick one. Has there been instances where somebody has made it through the background check process and then you've had these problems, or is this trying to get ahead of it?
Mr. Hodson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, fortunately, the two that we know of, we've caught. But the difficulty we see is the policy has been made to massively expand the scope of expungement. Prior to January 1st, 2015, a person couldn't legally get their record expunged if they had a conviction. Well, that changed to every misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, petty misdemeanor, and over 70 different classes of felony convictions are now eligible for expungement by petition. Under the Clean Slate legislation that went into effect January 1st, 2025, BCA indicates that there are maybe as many as a half a million records that are subject to automatic expungement. Many of these convictions are not disqualifiers. Our board will not care about those. If somebody has been convicted of, careless driving, that's not going to impact their license or their ability to enter this profession. So we are limited. Our concern is to those offenses, and that's what's checked for right now, those that by statute are listed to be disqualifiers.
Representative Johnson. All right, any other questions for the testifiers or Representative Hudson? Representative Hudson, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As I've stated in the past, this is an industry that I spent a large portion of my young adulthood working in and had, as I stated before, unfettered access to facilities, contact with the public, contact with personnel, some jobs I carried a firearm. The level of trust required to do this job, both for your employer and the client and the folks who you're serving in these positions, is understandably and appropriately high, and this bill ensures that we're able to adhere to that standard. Thank you.
Representative Hudson renews his motion and recommend that House File 2825, as amended, is re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries, and House File 2825 is re-referred to Judiciary and Civil Law. Next bill on our agenda is House File 963, which allows the Department of Corrections to revoke early earned release incentive credits if the inmate violates the rules. The committee first heard this bill on February 25th, and it was laid over. We are taking up this bill to consider an amendment suggested by the Department of Corrections and move the bill out of committee. Chair Rarick is out ill today. Chair Moeller, is it okay if I move the bill from the chair position?
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Moeller. I move House File 963 before the committee with a recommendation that it is re-referred to the General Register. I also move that the A2 amendment be brought before the committee. What's that? Yeah. So I move the A2 before the committee. Please, Commissioner Snell, please come to the table and describe the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Paul Snell. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. Thank you for this opportunity. As the chair mentioned, I'll get to the A2 amendment here. Chair, we have no concerns about this, and we, as we've testified before on this, The bill language proposed by Representative Rarick is consistent with the policies the agency formalized earlier this year, and we appreciate that Representative Rarick's effort to codify this into law. The language in the A2 amendment ensures consistency between the incarceration provisions that Representative Rarick addresses in her bill and the supervision side of MRA. Current law requires that an individual be transitioned to a supervision abatement status once they've earned enough credits, even if the commissioner has remaining concerns about public safety. These changes would both allow and direct the commissioner to weigh any concerning behavior and stability or other potential public safety risks before awarding supervision abatement, therefore ensuring the balance between rewarding individuals for compliance and ensuring public safety. We believe this amendment will further strengthen the intent of House File 963 and provide the necessary flexibility to manage both fairness and safety. And with that, Chair, I would stand for any questions once you've done what you need to do on your side.
Are there any questions for Commissioner Snell? Representative, or Chair Mohler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Commissioner Schnell, and I know Chair Rarick isn't here, but if I know Chair Rarick, she will be listening if she's able.
She is.
And so just wanted to thank her for her work on this with the commissioner. Thank you.
Any other questions? All in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion carries and the A2 amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussion on the bill? With that, I renew my motion that House File 963, as amended, is re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion carries, and House File 963, as amended, is re-referred to the General Register. Commissioner Snell, you can stay at the table, because the next bill is your deficiency funding request. And Chair Mohler, would you like to do it from there? And go ahead, Chair Mohler. Explain your, would you like to move House File 3006 before the Ways and Means with the recommendation is referred to the Ways and Means Committee?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair, and this is the Department of Corrections deficiency funding request that was in their broader package that we had. We decided it with the targets, the way they were determined, that this would travel as a standalone bill, and so that's why we are pulling it out. And I'm not even going to try to explain what it covers, because I know Commissioner Schnell is able to do that.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, members, once again, Paul Schnell, the Department of Corrections Commissioner, here to speak to the House File 3006, the deficiency request. The DOC is requesting $9.1 million from the state's general fund, as well as legislative approval to reallocate $10 million in appropriated funds to address our budget shortfall for fiscal year 2025. Approval of this request is vital to ensure the continued operation of state correctional facilities and to maintain the critical services and staffing necessary for public safety. As you heard during my testimony at last Friday's public safety hearing, the primary reason for the deficiency stems from the extraordinary improvements in staffing levels within the DOC. As you are well aware, the department has historically faced significant challenges in recruiting and retaining staff. However, we're pleased to report that due to the new competitive compensation packages that were negotiated and previous investments from this committee in our recruitment and retention efforts, the DOC has made considerable strides in attracting and retaining skilled and stable workforce. At the beginning of 2025 and presently, our staffing levels within the DOC stand at 99%, which is a dramatic improvement from the just 76% staffing level we had in 2020. This is a major achievement that is both vital to ensuring the safety and security of the facility, as well as providing essential services to those who are incarcerated. However, these staffing increases, while critically important, have also placed substantial pressure on the department's budget. The DOC has traditionally relied on major vacancy savings and funds saved due to unfilled positions, and generally speaking, substantial supplemental budget requests following collective bargaining in order to cover our budgetary needs. However, with now the vast majority of these position fills, obviously vacancy funding is no longer a viable strategy. The combination of staffing improvements and rising costs associated with retaining staff has created the funding shortfall that demands immediate attention. Without the requested fund, the DOC will face significant operational challenges, potentially jeopardizing our ability to meet financial obligations by June of 2025. In the worst-case scenario, we would be forced to implement lockdowns across our facilities to drastically reduce staffing needs and curb overtime costs. Such measures would be detrimental, as it could be lead to dangerous levels of idleness among our population, and we would see increased risk of population instability, which exacerbates safety concerns for both staff and incarcerated individuals. Passage of this bill as a standalone will ensure the continued safe and efficient operation of our facilities and maintenance of the services we provide. I want to thank both Chair Mueller and Chair Novotny for the support of this proposal and your continued leadership. And with that, Chairs, I would stand for any questions your members may have.
Questions for Commissioner Snell? Representative Tadke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I don't have a question for Commissioner Snell. I just want to make sure that put my support in for this, having Shakopee President and Shakopee. It's really important that we have these positions funded and making sure that we have adequate staffing and staffing levels. So just really appreciate everyone working together to find a compromise and making sure that we are supporting this work. So thank you, everyone.
Ball, I'll let you close, but my comment would be Chair Mueller, or that Commissioner Snell, I'm glad that we are getting up to staffing levels that have been a problem since I started here in 2020. I hope that this makes a significant difference in the quality of work experience for the correctional officers that were there and being able to be rested, not overworked. Their home life is restored from not working endless overtime, and hopefully that also has the secondary effect of helping with retention on the backside, that people aren't getting burnt out. With that, Chair Mueller, would you like to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't have said it better, so thanks for supporting the bill.
Chair Mueller renews her motion that House File 3006 is recommended to be referred to Ways and Means Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries, and House File 3006 is referred to Ways and Means. Next, we have four bills, all of which represent a savings to the general fund. All session, we have heard bills that expend funding, including bills that would total more than $40 million in general appropriations funds just yesterday. But we have not heard any bills that rein in spending, and with a looming budget deficit, it is important that we offer solutions to that deficit. The first of these bills that we will hear today, the first of four bills, is 467. Representative Harder, please come to the table with your testifier. Representative Harder, would you like to move House File 467 before the committee?
Yes, Chair Novotny, I'd like to move the file.
Representative Harder, please describe your bill and have your testifier testify on the bill.
Chair Novotny, if I may ask, I have a DE1. Did you want
we,
to
We will
to
get
do
at that.
That.
Just describe the bill.
Thank you, Chair Novotny and Chair Mueller and committee members for the opportunity to hear this bill today on the correctional fees. I appreciate Representative Feist for bringing forward the bill yesterday, which relates to this topic. So Minnesota has one of the highest probation rates in the nation, and great strides have been made to reshape the funding formula in the last biennium. The legislature has made a good faith commitment to fully fund this formula in the future, which is why there is a delay the request will be for the delay in the fee sunset. I have with me a testifier today. We can move to the testifier.
All right, first testifier is Mike McMullen of Wright County Probation. Mr. McMullen, begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Harder, for leadership on this issue. It is a very serious issue facing us. And we understand the state's dilemma and the upcoming budget process. And we understand it from a county level, and we appreciate it. But under the situation that we're faced with, it'll be detrimental, first of all, if the continued funding does not take place as biennium. In addition, if you add on the sunset that ties the hands of counties to fund current probation services, there will be a hit. And I want to give a personal example. It's why I'm representing Wright County today, not one of the associations. In Wright County alone, if continued funding does not take place to the funding that was put in place the last biennium, for the first year, we're gonna experience about a quarter of a million dollar decrease just based on salaries, incidental costs, and operations. In the second year, the biennium will be another $250,000+. Currently, we collect about $250,000 in fees. So that alone would be almost a $750,000 hit just to Wright County. And I wanted to say that in context. I think sometimes we get caught up in the bills and what doesn't really happen at the ground level. And clearly, probation is a very important part of public safety. We work with all the players in public safety. We just heard from law enforcement on a daily basis. We're certainly concerned about and would love to get the bill passed for continued funding. But if not, we support the bill to repeal and or at least move the sunset a few years forward. I believe it's 2 years.
Thank you, Mr. McMullen. The next testifier we have signed up is Will Cooley from the Minnesota Justice Research Center. Mr. Terrell, is he here? I don't see him. And you're not testifying on his behalf?
Okay.
All right. With that, we'll go on to questions. Actually, let's do House file or the amendment DE1. Mr. Cooley, we just went past you. Would you like to speak still? Take the stand quickly. Mr. Cooley, begin your testimony.
Just coming from another meeting.
Mr. Cooley, begin.
My name is Will Cooley. I'm the policy director at the Minnesota Justice Research Center. In regards to HF 467, the Minnesota Justice Research Center puts forth these statistics. I have some stats here. I'll go through them slowly. In 2022, people were assessed $13.8 million in supervision fees, but only $6.4 million were collected. Why? Approximately two-thirds of people on probation have incomes below $20,000 per year, and nearly two in five make less than $10,000, placing them well below the poverty line. As the conservative scholar William R. Maurer notes from the Institute of Justice, and there should be an Institute of Justice letter in your packet, the fines and fees system is dehumanizing, often leading to decades-long debts and stripping people of their freedom, particularly those who are less fortunate. Maurer urges us to oppose a system that extracts revenue from individuals even when they are unable to pay. Minnesota's probation officers have a tough job, but they are doing it well. In a survey from 2021, 90% of people on probation described their experience with Hennepin County probation officers as respectful and fair. We've spoken to many supervision agents across the state, and they tell us what they need: more housing options, more effective substance abuse programs, more employers willing to take second chances. They have never told us to burden their clients with excessive fees they often cannot pay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooley. Back to DE1. Is there any discussion on the DE1? Actually, Representative Harder described the DE1.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. And I also want to thank to Representative Feist and Chair Moeller, and there were others for working on the DE1. On this amendment, which the bill right now that I have is to repeal the sunset, but the DE1 is to move that to 2029.
Is there any discussion on the DE1? Representative Price.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Harder, for working with us on this amendment. You know, for the reasons that Mr. Cooley stated, I don't think that supervision fees are the best way to fund community supervision. And I think they can be very counterproductive. That said, I definitely understand the financial strain that our counties are under at this moment in time. And because we're not able to yet fully fund the new funding formula, I understand that that still creates a strain on the counties. So, you know, while I very strongly believe that we should get rid of supervision fees in the long term, I think this is a reasonable middle ground, and I support the amendment, and thank you for working with me on it.
Is there any other discussion on DE1? All in favor of adopting DE1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The DE1 carried. Commissioner Snell, you're still here, I believe. Do you have anything you'd like to say on this bill?
No.
With that, do we have any other questions for Representative Harder or the testifiers? With that, Representative Harder moves. Closing comments, Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair and Votney members, for hearing the bill. And I just appreciate the working together on this bill. And I believe it's going to be laid over. I have that correct. So thank you for that.
Thank you. With that, House File 467, and amended, is laid over. Next bill on the agenda is House File 2812. Representative Steer, please come back to the testifier table. Representative Steer, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
That is my motion.
Please describe your bill.
All right. During the 2023-2024 legislative session, House File 2922 passed, which allows free communication services to incarcerated persons. I was unable to locate the fiscal note on the House side, but was able to find one on the Senate side. So prior to the implementation of in fiscal year 2022, the revenue to ViaPath, formerly GTL, for inmate phone calls was $3.367 million, for which the agency received 40% commission of $1.374 million. And House File 2922 added a cost of $3.367 million. All right, commissions paid in fiscal year 2022 and prior funded social welfare programs, which several different types of programs, including entertainment, recreation, educational and religious programming, supplies, library support, and IP newspaper expenses. In the 2022 Senate fiscal note, expenditures totaled $8.143 million to implement this program, along with lost revenue of $1.3 million. Commissioner Snell testified last Friday, stating that inmates are using up to 7 million minutes per month. Commissioner Snell stated, the corrections staff are unable to monitor all communications. In my opinion, this is making our jails less safe for corrections staff to work in. With the implementation of House File 2922, the fiscal note should have included enough full-time employees to monitor all inmate phone calls to ensure their safety of the facility and the general public from the threats from inside. The cost broken down to 7 million minutes a month is 23,333 minutes a day, and that would take 162 full-time employees to monitor 24 hours calls, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. 162 full-time employees and an average income with benefits averaged out at $100,000 would cost taxpayers $16.2 million. The argument to keep free phone calls will include studies showing the incarcerated persons who maintain strong family community ties find it easier to reenter society to become the community again and have lower recidivism rates. Another point will be free jail phone calls remove financial burdens from family and friends. Commissioner Snell mentioned on Friday that correction facilities are dealing with the gangs are controlling the phones. He mentioned implementing a policy to fix the issue. So gangs are controlling the phones and people aren't able to use them. And that is my bill. I can take any questions.
Thank you, Representative Steer. Commissioner Snell, would you like to speak on this? Looks like yes. Please go to the table, state your name, and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, Paul Schnell, again, Commissioner of Corrections, and I just I appreciate the opportunity to speak to this, and I recognize and understand the challenges that that are raised here around some of the security issues, which we believe that we have identified strategies to implement and manage. I do think that it is important that we really offset and think about and consider the policy impacts, as Representative Steer, I think, rightly pointed out, that that these types of policies do have significant and positive impact on the incarcerated population, recidivism, and their ability to maintain contact with their families. I think it's also really important to note that the economic hardship created by charging for these phone calls, and we are one of four states in the nation right now that that passed this type of bill, really places a burden on families, and most often single moms, who are already facing difficult circumstances. During the legislative session, we heard people testify that oftentimes these calls were costing them, their families, between $100 and $200 per month. And when we factor the reality that incarcerated people working in our prisons are earning somewhere between 25 cents an hour and with a maximum of about $2 an hour, the ability to pay for these phone calls, the cost of confinement, any type of restitution that may be owed is virtually impossible. Therefore, the cost for these calls fall squarely and flatly on the families and, frankly, on the children of incarcerated people. And we have to recognize that having an incarcerated parent has been identified as one significant adverse childhood experience. And the impact of parental incarceration is mitigated when kids can maintain close contact with their parent who's incarcerated. And I can tell you that oftentimes these phone calls involve people who are incarcerated on the phone with their kids doing homework in an evening. As was pointed out, you know, we are seeing the use, and we have seen the use of the phones go up dramatically, 7 million minutes a month, as was noted. We think that that is a positive sign. Now, we do know and are aware that at no time in our history have we ever monitored every phone call, and there is not a jail or a prison system in the country that actively monitors every phone call in real time. As is well noted, any calls that come from a correctional facilities are recorded, and they are accessed and used by our intelligence people as may be necessary. But we do not and cannot monitor every call. We do believe that, the future really is around the use of AI to actively do that and help staff identify potential threats or risk factors that may come up on these calls. But I think the reality of today is that when we think about the positive impacts, we understand the economic challenges here. But what we are going to do as a state by stopping this practice is put this on this burden squarely at the feet and on the shoulders and the backs of families and kids. And that does not serve our interest overall. I also think it's just really important that we are aware of that, you know, that more than a third of families across the country with an incarcerated family member go into debt because of the cost of phone calls. And again, we pay for that. There is a real social and governmental cost that comes to this. And creates other sorts of problems. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I would stand for any questions you have about this bill and about what's happening within the DOC.
Well, Commissioner Snell, it seems to me the numbers that Representative Steer quoted as far as the current costs that we're running do not meet what was allocated in the last session when that bill was proposed. Is that a fair statement? Are we exceeding what was already budgeted for these free phone calls?
Mr. Chair, members, we do see that now. One of the things I can't say is that the FCC passed rules governing phone calls, and in January of 25, there was a reduction of cost of the DOC of phone calls by 40%. So those some of those numbers have gone down to the point now where we believe that the cost of phone calls is somewhere in the vicinity of about I'm ballparking this a little bit, about $2.5 million a year versus the 3.5. So some of this is just new information as we look at the reduction in costs that were passed along because of the FCC requirements.
So even with the reduced costs, it's still more than we budgeted, no?
No, Mr. Chair, it would be now less than the budgeted amount, slightly less.
Either way, right now, you know, you said that the cost is squarely and flatly on the incarcerated person as a if we change this, but right now it's squarely and flatly on the taxpayers no matter what it costs, correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question for the author. I see to a letter in opposition. I hear the Department of Corrections raising some concerns. Can you tell me who you worked with who supports this bill?
I think the Republican
Representative
Party.
Representative Steer.
Sorry. I think the Republican Party supports this bill.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. I guess what I would say is I think that this is a penny-wise, pound-foolish bill. And as I think the research shows, that was used to pass this bill in the last biennium, you know, the creating of family connections, its impact on both recidivism, the safety within and outside of our incarcerated jails and prisons, as well as the impact it has on our communities. The defunding family connections, this bill, I think, goes in the wrong direction from where we were in. I'll give three sort of reasons, and most of them, I think, actually the commissioner alluded to, but it's the wrong direction for public safety. The family connections that we know are linked to, and the research shows, to positive behaviors both in prison as well as reducing recidivism. So when we think about, and I think it was a prison policy initiative, it lowers violence in prisons. That's good for inmates. It's also good for our correctional staff. This is also wrong for the families of the folks who have been incarcerated. As the commissioner said, a third of families go into debt because of the prison phone calls. This doesn't stop the phone calls. It just means people who can't afford it go into debt because they want to make these calls. If you are wealthy, this bill, this doesn't affect you at all. You can continue making those phone calls. The emotional lifeline to kids and families, that we're talking about kids being able to connect with their incarcerated parents or spouses, both for the incarcerated person and thinking about entering back into the into society in a way that we want to make sure happens and is good for and safe for our communities, but also those kids and those families who need to be able to talk to their loved one. And then I would also say this is the wrong direction for basic fairness. Because again, all this does is say, it doesn't stop the phone calls you're talking about. It doesn't solve the problems. It just says if you can afford it, you can make those calls. But if you can't, maybe your family will go into debt. Maybe you will use the 25 cents an hour, which would mean for every hour you work is you're paying for a phone call or for a minute of a phone call. That's just not fair. And so I really appreciate, I was not on public safety in the last couple of years, but as a public defender, I've spent a lot of time thinking about how do we reduce recidivism, how do we make sure that when people in our communities, they come out of incarceration in a way that they're ready to be back in the communities, maintaining their relationships with those families and communities is critical. And that's what this bill does. And so I would say, members, I think this is being laid over, but I oppose the bill and say we should stick with connecting communities, not defunding them.
Representative Steer, response?
Just all good points you brought up, but this should not be on the backs of the taxpayers of Minnesota.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just have a comment. So I appreciate the letter that's in our packets from the Isaiah organization. They state that they believe that every human being is imbued with inherent dignity and worthy of love. So say we all. That's exactly why when you commit a violation of another human being's inherent dignity by committing an offense against them that qualifies you to be incarcerated, it's an appropriate punishment. And it comes with reductions in civil liberties. That's the definition. We get to confine you. Many things which otherwise would have been your right become privileges. That's what incarceration is. If you don't want to be subject to that, don't violate the inherent dignity of other human beings. I think that's the message we should be sending as a legislature. As far as the bill itself and its impact, I wonder how many of the researchers who have been promoting this idea have been visiting these facilities and seeing the activity that's been acknowledged by Commissioner Schnell and was described by Representative Steer of these phones now being in the control of gangs that are in the prisons. So I would argue that we have not eliminated the cost to make a phone call. We've simply transferred it from being a monetary cost to being whatever is demanded by somebody stronger and bigger and who has more people allied with them than you. That is a contributes to disorder rather than order. And as far as the cost, $100 to $200 a month, I think, you know, many of us pay about that much for our personal cell phones bill and our family's plans. If there's some sort of inherent right to be able to have connectivity to other people through these technological means, who's going to pay my bill, right? What we've done with this legislation that was passed last term is we have provided a right and privilege to people who have, again, violated the inherent dignity of our fellow human beings that we ourselves out here don't have. I think this is a good bill, and I do support it. Thank you.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for Commissioner Schnell here, and I'm actually going to piggyback off of Representative Hudson and actually talk more about some of the damages that are happening with inside the correction facilities in regards to some of these gangs that are taking over these phones. And I would like you to explain to me how they are taking over these phones, or what have you heard? You know, are they taking money from this? Because I mean, when we're talking about the burdens of society and putting the burden on these families, aren't we doing the same thing when we're actually paying some gang members or paying these individuals to be able to use these phones? In essence, like, aren't we putting the burden back on some of these people that are inside the jail as well? Can you help me out with this, please?
Commissioner Stout.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the reality is there's a lot of ways that in a correctional setting that people can be exploited. As it stands with the phones, it may not be that they're paying to use the phone. It may be that if I am a member of a security threat group, the only people I allow to use that phone is members of my my group. And the way that we now have to manage and implement strategies to do this. I want to be clear. We had phone issues and problems and challenges before phone calls were free. That's a reality, and we've always had to manage. This just simply increased the volume of those challenges, and so we have to implement other strategies to address it. But I just want to be. I think it's really important to know that free phone calls didn't create the problems. Free phone calls simply made those challenges somewhat larger and across the board.
Representative Duran.
So again, we're still creating a burden for people incarcerated because they're going to be in debt, or they're going to be limited in their time, or you know there's going to be something going on with these gang members monitoring these phones. But it's strange because you said that now it exaggerated, you know, expanded the concerns with these phone calls. So how are you, I guess, conducting yourself and protecting these inmates who are inside there to not go down this, because now it's worse, and it doesn't look like we have any, you know, any plan to solve this. I'm worried about that.
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we understand that, and one of the things that we just implemented was a new strategy around creating some blocks in between. The phone calls are set; they're limited. People could, in many cases in the past, do back-to-back calls. That has been changed. So now there is a minimum of a 15-minute gap between calls, which just allows for staff to better manage and monitor that because of the gap that's built into the system, number one. Number two, different facilities use different strategies dependent upon the issue or the problem. And I want to be clear, too, that we're not talking about every single phone in every single facility in every single unit. We have units where the challenges can be greater, but we are dealing with not just these security challenges. We deal with a host of challenges that our security staff, I think, do a remarkable job with. But we can do some things by creating gaps between calls that will allow it us to more easily manage and monitor phone usage.
Representative Duran. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Thank you, Commissioner Snell. One of my questions was going to be the solution, because last week we heard about the issue, so thank you for that. I got two questions. One is, how much of an increase have we seen since this program's been implemented? And then secondly, I'm trying to wrap my head around this a little bit. If it's a landline, why is it so expensive?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, I think just as to the first question, when you talk about the change in usage, are you speaking about the volume of calls? Or
yes.
Yeah. The volume of calls has gone, as I pointed out, we were running prior to this about three to 3.5 thousand minutes a month. 350,000 minutes per month. Now that we're averaging, as I said, 7 million minutes of phone call usage. So it has gone up, doubled in the course of that time. So when we look at that volume, it undoubtedly has gone up quite dramatically in that time.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you. And so that's a high percentage of increase in calls, and I can see where there could be some unintended consequences that have caused some issues. So, like I said, once again, I'm glad you have a plan, but then that limits people making those phone calls to their families. I guess my other question is, why the high cost if it's a landline?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is a great question, and it's one of the issues that the FCC really took up based on a change in law, bipartisan bill that was brought in U.S. Congress. The FCC was required to look into and address the cost of communications, and ultimately Congress required the FCC to do rulemaking around the cost of these calls. When we look at what the costs are, it's really built on the fact that there are a relatively small number of providers that provide these services. And I think what's important, it's not just a phone on the wall or a phone. It is all of the ability to record every call, to advise people who are the person is calling, that the call is being recorded, if you've ever heard those communications. So all of that system contains and holds all of that, and then allows us on the backside to be able to go in, access that call, and do various things with that, including things like, in some instances, you can do some transcription things and those sorts of things from that system. So it's the back end of that comes with the cost. It would be really nice if we could just put hardwire phones in and allow people to access them, but all of the technology related to the back end and the security side of that is where the challenges are, and that's where the costs have been. And I think there has been concern, and obviously the concern of Congress was the fact that the costs were quite high, and so that's why the FCC was came in and required was required to do rulemaking.
Representative Woody.
Promise my last question. So I'm guessing because we're up to 7 million calls a month from 3,000, that's why it's increased, because of it's not just a overall bill thing. It's monitored by the calls because you got to do all the back end stuff.
Commissioner Snell.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes. I mean, the cost, obviously, one of the things that's happened is that the costs have gone down a little bit because of FCC, but it really, at the end of the day, it is the volume of costs that require the funding.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Steer, for bringing this bill so we can have this conversation. I'm going to be limited in what I say. I just got a couple of points. The first thing I want to acknowledge is that I hear you when you say that there are problems. I hear when we talk about gang control and the cost and the number of minutes that are coming up. But I do have to, I'm going to have to vote against this bill or not support it for a couple of important reasons. So the first one is we talked about people who have committed crimes and who have violated other folks' rights. But you know who didn't commit crimes and violate other people's rights are the kids and the spouses of those people who have been incarcerated. And they're the ones that have to bear the burden here. It's not the folks in prison. They're never going to make enough money to be able to afford these phone calls. The people who do is the wife who's on the outside, who is trying to maintain a connection with their spouse, or trying to make sure their kid maintains a connection with their dad or with their mom. They're the ones that bear that burden, and they're the ones that can't afford hundreds of dollars every month. And by the way, those people are taxpayers. When we say this is falling on the back of taxpayers, they pay taxes. It's their money too that's going to this. So, you know, and far be it from any of us to think that we will not be in the situation where our spouse might be imprisoned. I don't want to name names here, but there are people who work in this building who never thought that they would have to be dealing with this with their spouse being in prison, right? So, like, let's not go there. You never know what's going to happen. And I'm sure that all of us would like to not have to spend an extra $200 to $250 to talk to our spouse and to try and maintain a connection with our spouse or for our kids to have a connection with them. Secondly, we talk about inherent value of all people. Yes, 100%. And also, your inherent value should not be based on how much money you have. If we are talking about folks who are white-collar criminals and who have money in the bank, or have had professional jobs for years and years and have savings and can afford to pay for those calls, their humanity is the same as somebody who worked at a gas station supermarket and doesn't have any savings. And we need to acknowledge that through our legislation. And it's important for them to stay connected to their community and to their family just as much as it is for the white-collar criminal to stay connected to them. Finally, the humanity aspect, and this is from my own personal experience. I didn't work in criminal law, but I did work in family law, and I can tell you the number one thing that makes people stop trying and stop working at stuff is taking away their family and their kids. When you tell people you no longer have access to their children, they shut down. They are not willing to work on things. They are not willing to try harder. They are not willing to try to rehabilitate. It is like something dies inside of them. And I think any of us that are parents can kind of identify how that would feel. Like, we all know how that would impact us. And from that perspective, I see this as actually a cost savings measure, because I don't know the average cost of housing an inmate for a year or what the average length of stay is for an inmate, but I'm gonna guess that with all the inmates we have in our prison systems, if they all get out, and because they feel no connection and because they've lost touch with their kids and their family and they commit other crimes, it's going to cost a whole heck of a lot more. Sorry. It's going to cost a whole heck of a lot more than paying for these phone calls. And so I really would encourage us to take a position that is looking at not just the immediate cost, but the long-term cost and what our goal is of our prison system and our incarceration system. And I know I harp on this a lot, but I think that we all believe that most people who are being incarcerated, we want them to be rehabilitated and become functioning members of our society. I think the goal is not to lock people up and never look back at them. That cannot be the goal. We can't afford to do that. You want to talk about budget issues. If we do that, we will absolutely have budget issues. So if we want people to come back, to reintegrate into society, to find jobs, to participate in our communities, they need to feel connected to those communities. And yes, there is a cost to that, but I think it's a cost that is worth bearing to recognize the humanity in everybody and make sure that they have a chance at coming back and being fully participating members of our community. That's a cost I'm willing to take. So that wasn't a question. Sorry. Thank you.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had to present a bill when this discussion started, so I missed a large part of it. But I did hear that a question was asked about who supports this and that the answer was Republicans. Well, that's not true across the country. There are red states that are providing these valuable connections for families, and particularly for what Representative Holland spoke to about maintaining that connection. And we heard from Oklahoma in December about how they this has been really successful in helping rehabilitate people. They have an iPad, and someone was able to see their kid graduate from high school, and that meant so much to the family and to the person because it helps rehabilitate people and helps maintain those family connections. So I just want to be clear that this is not something that that just blue states or Democrats are trying to do. This is bipartisan because it works. You can tell from our side we're very opposed to this bill, and just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Well, our side is not very opposed to the bill. We're open for discussions, and Commissioner Snell, I think at some point we have to find a happy medium somewhere. I will say, though, that Representative Hollins, if we go by your math, if what we had before with paid phone calls and the number of calls that were going out to the amount of phone calls we have now, which back of the envelope is approximately 3,000% increase in the amount of calls that were made and minutes that are made. So if we go by your theory, then we should be able to zero out the corrections budget within a couple of years because there won't be any crime. I appreciate that there is legitimacy to what you're saying, Representative Hollins, but it's not everything that you are pointing it out to be. And I would suspect if you wanted to arrange with one of the fine members of the Ramsey County Sheriff's today to go on and sit down to listen to a couple of hours of jail phone calls, it might change your mind on how valuable those jail calls are with no limits on them. Representative Steer, closing comments.
All right. House File 2812 will bring back $1.3 million in commissions to fund social welfare programs, eliminate the $3.36 million in fees assessed back onto the general public, and allow correction staff to monitor the facility, in which will turn the facility safer, along with everyone in the general public. Thank you.
And with that, House File 2812 is laid over. The next two bills on the agenda are mine. Vice Chair Witte, please take over.
Thank you.
Chair Novotny, would you like to move House File 2892 before the committee?
I would.
Chair Novotny, can you please describe your bill?
What's our motion we're starting on? Which bill are we starting on?
2892.
2892. In 2016, the legislature made multiple changes to provisions of the law related to controlled substance offenses. Part of that change, the legislature...
Hey, Chair Novotny, can I have you speak in the mic? Thank you.
The legislature established a community justice reinvestment account. Money in the account was to be used for grants to support mental health, chemical dependency treatment programs, and other programs related to controlled substance offenses. In 2019, the legislature established a statutory transfer of $461,000 each year from the general fund into the account. This bill repeals that account and annual transfer.
Thank you. I see we, no one signed up to testify on the bill, so we'll move to member discussion. Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess at some point we did get a letter just now from the Department of Public Safety expressing concerns about this bill. And I would like to at some point see a list of the kinds of programs that this supports. It sounds like, you know, mental health and maybe substance use disorder treatment are part of those. And I just want to say that with, again, some of the cuts that are coming from the federal level, these are the kinds of things where I don't know why that's funny. It is not a joke that these cuts are coming, and I'm trying to say it in a way that is not inflammatory but reality, and we know that there are cuts to these kinds of treatments for people, for mental health, for substance abuse, et cetera. So I'm trying not to say it in an inflammatory way, but just the reality that those have been threatened and some cuts have started already. And so I just want to make sure that if this is a program that we're cutting here, that the same people that are benefiting from this aren't going to be cut because of additional federal dollars that could be cut. So I know, Representative Bliss, you're looking at that's the point I'm trying to make here. I'm not trying to be inflammatory, just want to make sure that these programs are also not getting federal dollars that could potentially be cut. And that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Representative Bliss. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a quick follow-up, I don't know if you saw the budget forecasts of $6 billion deficit in the next couple of years. And you know, we had $18 billion surplus squandered. We had $10 billion in taxes squandered. All of that before a presidential election, that side of the table has continuously blamed our financial or future financial woes on. The reason I chuckle is because I find it hilarious that every time we try to offer something up to cut a little bit money to maybe try to help the $6 billion deficit that we are facing, that I don't believe anybody on this side of the aisle had any input on that budget. So that's on you. So any of the stuff that we're trying to do to save a little bit of money, and then we get the, well, Trump, that these mythical cuts that are coming down the road that haven't hit yet. And, you know, it's funny, but the $6 billion deficit that we're facing has nothing to do with the man sitting at 600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Thank you.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the cuts have hit, and in fact, Minnesota Department of Health had just ended up laying off a bunch of people due to federal cuts. So the cuts have hit. I just received information today about a number of federal cuts again related to victim services. So they are there and other ones are threatened. And so that is a reality that we are in right now. And we did fund things that were Republican before in the past, the last biennium as well. So wasn't, you know, no, we could talk about the last biennium probably forever, and that's not the point of this bill. But I do think it is important to this bill to understand if there are federal cuts coming to these things, how does that impact? I didn't say we are a hard no on this bill. I just said I wanted to understand that a little bit more and understand where the various funding sources for those types of programs are coming from.
Moving forward, closing remarks, Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Vice Chair Witte. I agree with Chair Mueller. The the reality is the cuts are coming, and that's one of the reasons why we need to pull back and reevaluate where the funding is going. The last numbers that our House fiscal staff were to find where these funds went to was 2020, and I have the list here. 180,000 went to the second judicial district. 200,000 went to the Duluth Police Department, Hennepin County, Waseca County, and the White Earth Tribal Band. Very specific, not statewide funding. It was not broad. It didn't go to a lot of places. It was very specific, and it was some people really won and some people really lost. As I said, that's the last we could get from fiscal, so we don't even know where that money is going. But this is one of the reasons why we brought this bill forward. We need to reevaluate. If it's bad this year, just think what it's going to be like when the projected surplus that has been coming since we knew, since we walked out last year, are coming. And I support this bill.
Thank you. And that House File 2892 is going to be laid over. The next bill on our agenda is House File 2532. Chair Novotny, would you like to move House File 2532 before the committee?
That's correct.
Please describe your bill.
In 2023, the legislature established a community crime and violence prevention account in the special revenue fund. The legislation also transferred $70 million from the general fund into the account and authorized the Department of Public Safety to use up to $14,000 each year for grants that meet the requirements of Section 299A.296. This bill eliminates that account and transfers the balance of $42 million to the general fund. That is my bill, Vice Chair Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. There are no author testifiers, but we do have some members of the public who signed up to testify. Each testifier will have 1.5 minutes to testify. Please be brief, concise, and please state your name and organization when you come up. Our first public testifier, and I do apologize if I get the names wrong, Maggie Emery, and then Jordan Bora Nelson.
Good afternoon, chairs and members of the committee. My name is Maggie Emery, and I'm the executive director of Protect Minnesota, which is the only state-based, statewide gun violence prevention organization here in Minnesota. I am here to strongly oppose any effort to pull back community violence intervention funding. This is not just a budgetary issue. It's a public safety issue, a life or death issue for many communities here in our state. Community violence intervention programs save lives. This model, which is used across the country, treats violence as a public health crisis, interrupting cycles of retaliation, mediating conflict before they escalate, and connecting individuals in need to support services. In cities that have implemented these strategies, violence has been reduced by 30 to 60% in target areas. Here in Minnesota, community-led programs have been instrumental in reducing shootings and violent crime. You may have heard recently about the reduction in North Minneapolis in gun violence, particularly in our most impacted neighborhoods. Investing in CBI isn't just effective in reducing violence, it's also cost effective, which is what we're here today to talk about. Studies show that every $1 spent on violence interruption and prevention saves up to $5 in reduced medical costs, incarceration, and lost productivity. In contrast, when funding is pulled, we see spikes in violent crime, overburdened law enforcement, and rising emergency room costs. Cutting this funding isn't just short-sighted, it's dangerous. We must continue funding proven community-based solutions that address violence at its roots. I urge you to protect these dedicated dollars today and uphold your commitment to real public safety on this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up, we have Jordan Bora Nelson, and then on deck, Ryan Provencia.
Good evening. Thank you for hearing me this evening. I'm Jordan Bora Nelson, executive director of Mad Dads Minneapolis. And I'm just here to talk a little bit about the work that we do in South Minneapolis. Last year, we interrupted or intervened in 569 situations that could have erupted in violence or were violent, and our violence intervention team stepped in between that, and they stopped the situation from escalating. One story, two individuals had knives and were going to get into a knife fight under a bridge on Chicago Lake, and our team intervened on that scene with we don't carry weapons, and they intervened to be able to de-escalate the situation, and they saved two lives that day. And then also the employment piece that comes along with it. Most of the people that we hire have lived experiences coming from the community, coming from either being justice impacted or they don't have a lot of work experience, and they gain that experience with us, and then we're able to help them go on into a career field or a career path of their choice. Just a few testimonies from local business owners. Muhammad from the Ellen Halal Market said, "I see you guys around outside in the cold doing your jobs. I definitely feel safer when I see you patrolling the streets. It's hard for the police to come to every single incident, or it takes a while, so it's good to have you guys here for sure." We are great. Gilberto Rivera, the general manager from the Four Corners Market, testified that we are grateful for the Mad Dad staff and their patrols. They have helped us several times. When people are causing trouble, we call them and they respond immediately. My staff have noticed that when customers arrive and see them, they feel secure and enjoy their stay more. Mario from the Mexicana supermarket said, "Mad Dads come several times a week, always checking in and asking if everything is okay. Their presence benefits not just us, but also people walking on the street. They make the community feel safer, and they help people who need to straighten out. Those struggling with drugs or making bad choices, their work is a great help." So this funding that has been provided to us does pose a great need in our community, and it does help and prevent violence. Lastly, there was a news story yesterday on CBS News about Brooklyn, New York, where they had proven that 482 days without a shooting in Brooklyn, New York, based on similar initiatives to what we do with community violence intervention. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jordan. Next up, Ryan, and on deck, Leah Condis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ryan Pervenanzi, I know it's a mouthful, so I appreciate the effort. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Mueller, members. My name is Ryan Pervenanzi again, speaking on behalf of Carlson County. You know, these funds the city or the county receives about $425,000 we did in the previous year. And those funds went to programs that specifically serve youth. I mean, they address issues, whether it's truancy, homelessness, and things like that. So it is a very important part of services provided by Carlson County. And, you know, it goes without saying. I mean, we, as a county, we completely understand the budget constraints that all of you are working so diligently to address. And we acknowledge that and thank you for all your work. But, you know, we just ask for careful consideration of taking these, you know, well-managed funds out of a county like Carlton, where we just don't have a lot of resources to give to our youth. You know, unfortunately, we're not part of the city of Duluth where they have a HUD entitlement where they have $3 million to invest in the community. We just don't have those resources. So I'm on behalf of the county, I would just like you know, to respectfully ask for kind of reconsidering of funds like these and the importance that they really do bring into Carlton County. So thank you very much for your time and all your work.
Thank you, Ryan. Up next, Leah, and on deck I have Moms Demand Action. Tom Steinmetz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Leah Condis, and I lead the Minneapolis local group of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. More importantly, I am the mother of a child who was at the mall for one of their shootings and the state fair for one of their shootings. I'm here today in opposition to House File 2532, which could eliminate funding for community violence intervention or CVI programs. As Representative Greenman might say, this bill is penny wise and pound foolish. The legislation aims to reallocate $42 million from the Community Crime and Violence Prevention Account to the State General Fund. Meanwhile, injuries and deaths from gun violence are estimated to cost Minnesota around $6.6 billion annually. CBI programs are proven to reduce gunshot wounds and deaths in the neighborhoods most impacted by gun violence. To date, 41 states dedicate funding to these programs. The presence of violence in communities is associated with chronic or acute conditions such as poor mental health, reduced cognitive functioning for children, and inequity in housing, economic opportunity, and educational attainment. These programs play a crucial role in combating gun violence and need to be properly funded and sustained. Moms Demand Action has had the privilege of partnering with many community-based partners to reduce gun violence, including the Next Step program at Hennepin Healthcare, Touch Outreach and Restoration Incorporated. I urge lawmakers to reject this short-sighted proposal. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next, Tom, and on deck, Justin Terrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for your commitment to the safety of people across Minnesota. My name's Tom Steinmetz, and I'm speaking to you today as both the executive director of the Healthy Community Initiative in Rice County and also as a violent crime victim. I'm professionally committed to reducing crime, and this issue is personal for me. After I was assaulted, it took years to recover, both physically and emotionally. Anyone who has experienced a violent crime knows that the effects stay with you long after the attack, sometimes for a lifetime. I hope that no one ever has to experience a violent crime, and that's why I'm opposed to this bill, to eliminate the community crime and violence prevention account. The Healthy Community Initiative's Community Crime Intervention and Prevention Project works directly with at-risk youth using evidence-based interventions with a strong focus on high school graduation and workforce development. This program has the strong support of the Northfield Police Department and many other community partners, and I'll be passing along a letter of support from the chief of the Northfield Police Department. Students in HCI's Check and Connect program have a 98% graduation rate. Those are all at-risk students. Check and Connect's a nationally recognized structured mentoring intervention for at-risk students. We focused on high school graduation because we all know that students who drop out are 5 times more likely to be arrested and 63% more likely to be incarcerated, and that increases in high school graduation have a huge return on investment. Through the Community College Collaborative Workforce Initiative, 2 students have already graduated with associate's degrees in law enforcement. And I'll end with a quote from Iris, one of the graduates, who said, "The program has provided me with the resources and tools to successfully complete my training in law enforcement and begin my career. The staff played a huge role in my success. Their guidance, support, and dedication made all the difference. Their encouragement, along with the support..."
Can I have you wrap up?
Yeah.
Thank you.
One more second. They were always there to offer help whenever I needed it, and I am proud to now serve as a police officer. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Justin Terrell. And up after him, Sheriff Bob Fletcher.
Can you guys hear me? All right. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Justin Terrell. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Justice Research Center. We're a small community-based nonprofit organization whose mission is to transform the criminal legal system, specifically to ensure it is more effective, humane, and trustworthy. I also want to just start by thanking Chair Novotny. While I may disagree with the premise of this bill, I actually think it's a great opportunity to hear about the great work that these organizations are doing out in the community. Today, I've been asked to raise concerns about this bill that would eliminate funding for community crime prevention efforts. These resources have been critical in developing effective strategies to advance public safety by making meaningful investments in community organizations who are positioned to intervene and prevent crime from happening. The work these organizations do is to be respected and appreciated. If for no other reason than that we know these organizations play a key role in addressing crime in our community, which makes us all safer and helps law enforcement, who I'm thankful who are also in the room today, be more effective at their jobs. In addition, I want to share some recent stats released by NPD in the city of Minneapolis that shows that crime in North Minneapolis, that notorious hotbed we love to talk about all the time, also the hub of our community, of the black community in our state, has dropped into 2014 levels, which researchers such as Patrick Charkey argue is the high water mark for being the safest year on record in our country. I'm not going to read all these stats, but just on the shooting victims side, in 2024, gunshot wound victims were at the lowest level since 2014, with 132 victims reported. This is a decrease of nearly 21%, 35 fewer victims from 2023 and within pre-pandemic levels. Gunshot incidents decreased 25% with 38 fewer incidents compared to previous year.
Terrell, can I have you wrap it up, please?
Yeah, I'm right there. So in closing, I will leave it to this body to do the work of advancing meaningful policy. It's your job, not mine. But I felt it responsible to share this data and make the case that law enforcement as an arm of the criminal legal system relies on community members to sustain safe communities. It is only reasonable that we fund these organizations to ensure they have the capacity to do so. I have to make two very quick points. First, I have to mention that there was a reporting requirement attached to this bill when it was passed, and I haven't seen any reports. I believe they were due in January, and I would look to the Commissioner of Public Safety and anyone else to see if law enforcement has provided their reporting on this, on the resources they received when this bill was passed, and I'd love to see the report on the hard work that
I'm going to have you end it right there.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. And I'm just going to say it. The second question is, I would like to make sure that folks understand that this, I believe, was one-time money with a five-year sunset. And it, considering the looming deficit, I don't believe this resources will have any impact on it. So we should keep them in the hands of folks that are actually doing the hard work of working hand-in-hand with law enforcement to make sure that our communities are safer. So this bill, Chair Novotny, may be...
Thank you, Terrell. I'm going to have you end it right there. Next up, Sheriff Bob Fletcher.
Ready? Sheriff Bob Fletcher, thanks for having me. Our youth outreach program serves about 200 to 300 kids every year. We've been doing that for literally 30 years. You might remember those of you that were here, which there aren't many, but the Office of Justice Programs used to issue grants. And so we are very aggressive at youth outreach programs. I want to tell you one story here about a couple of them. Chinu Lee, please stand. Chinu Lee is the undersheriff in our department. Stay on your feet. I'm going to talk about you. Chinu Lee was a part of our program when he was 8 years old. And we had an academic program, baseball, softball. He got into scouts. And Chinu Lee graduated then from high school. But when we first started working with Chinu, his dad would not let him go out. He lived in a housing project in McDonough. And there were so many gangs out there, Hmong gangs, that he wouldn't let him go out. But his father let him come to our program because he believed that it was going to be safe if he was at the sheriff's program. In fact, his dad wouldn't let him wrestle in high school because he thought wrestling was bad until I showed him my yearbook to show him that I wrestled at North St. Paul High School, and he said, okay, we're going to let him wrestle. So great success story, went on to work for us, and he's the highest-ranking Hmong deputy in the state of Minnesota. And he is also leading our youth program now, which does a great job. And he recruited, stand up there, Kaku. Kaku, our first Karen deputy, was recruited 5 years ago through the work that Chinu was doing with our youth program. These are just two examples of the work that our youth program is doing, and there are dozens of others positively impacted by the money that you graciously allowed us to have 2 years ago. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sheriff Fletcher. We're going to go to member discussion, but we do have one more bill we want to get through today. So, Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Novotny, for the bill. I am in support, not because I'm against a lot of these programs and a lot of the folks who came up and testified in favor of this funding, but because there are some folks who aren't here today who have unfortunately used these funds as a means of self-gain rather than allowing programs like this to actually see the light of day. These aren't cuts by the federal government or by Elon Musk or some mythological cut. These are cuts based off of greedy people within NGOs who seek to profit off of us trying to fund the good work of people who came up and testified. And I have a couple of sheets here that would help kind of just display how much greed we're talking. One group here, they received $1.8 million in grants in 2024 and 2025, and they spent 46.2% on their board, their board's overall salary. Another one, I can start saying them here too if that's easier, but another one's 49.6%, 61.49% of $1.8 million. 59% of $1.91 million. Overall, we have $30 million in grants here, and one out of every single two of those dollars is going to the pocket of somebody who's in an executive director position who's not going out and doing the work on the ground, who's not providing for these services that are helping people like these two officers who are obviously helping our communities today because of organizations that they were able to enter into. This is going towards bureaucratic bloat and government greed instead of the boots on the ground work. If we start with this bill and we get these funds back, we can then take a look and say which organizations are doing that good work that we should continue to fund, rather than just throwing out $30 million and allowing 12.6% to go towards a total of 84 executive director board member salaries. That's why I think that we should support this bill, and it's a good starting point. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Whitty. Thank you, Chair Novotny, for bringing this bill, I guess. Okay, So first I want to note that the City of St. Paul and their Project Peace, which is supported by their Public Safety Network, has also received $450,000 through this program. Which was very well spent and I think is really important for what we're trying to do in the City of St. Paul, trying to intervene with folks and make sure that they are stopped before they start committing crimes. I share concerns that Representative Engen has brought up, and I would love to see more about that. I do know that a lot of these organizations that do this work are really small. So when you say that it's going to an executive, like, there's nothing more than people that make up these organizations. There's not like usually a CEO who's at the top. But I would love to read more about it. And yeah, if you want to, I mean, I won't do it right now in front of you, but like, yeah, thank you. I'm definitely interested. And then of course, don't take this the wrong way, Chair Novotny, but I guess maybe you should talk to my Ramsey County Sheriff and you might have a different perspective.
I'll address that.
On the grant.
Any other discussion? Representative Duran.
Well, we heard today from a testifier that they intervened on a knife fight, and that actually tweaks my interest because now I'm trying to figure out what is their, you know, how are they intervening on some of these issues, what type of training they have, what are they doing to, or some of these intervention programs, you know, who's monitoring these people, you know, how do they are conducting themselves in these certain situations. And I think that is, Justin, right? Yeah, if you want to come up here, please. Yep. Yep.
Can we make this quick?
Real quick, yeah. Okay. So my deal is right now is like, what type of training are you're giving your individuals, and how are we knowing that that is coexisting with the community and some of the relationships of making sure that everybody's created fairly, right? In regard, because it doesn't look like there's really much oversight to this. So what I want to know is what type of training that you guys are offering, and how are you guys intervening on some of these tougher issues?
Thank you. That's a great question. I'm Jordan Bornelson, Executive Director, Mad Dads Minneapolis. So to the training piece, our team members are trained in CIT training through the Barbara Snyder Foundation called Crisis Intervention Training. We just had 10 team members trained last week, and it actually is the same training that the Minneapolis Police Department and Hennepin County Sheriffs receive. They're also trained in Cure Violence Global, which is an international organization that trains on violence interruption, and they have us focus on de-escalation in potentially violent situations or mediating them so violence doesn't spread like a disease. They're also trained by the Red Cross in CPR first aid. So they're actually trained in how to stop the bleed. If someone is shot, they are trained how to put a tourniquet on the wound, and they are trained in de-escalation through our years of history. We've been around since 1989 nationally, and our national organization used to work with the Justice Department on training for canvassing in communities, and we had a community center built in Omaha, Nebraska. What was the second question?
Are you guys trained on any kind of force restraints or anything like that? Do you guys do any of that?
We are not trained on use of force because the whole purpose of violence prevention and intervention is to prevent or intervene if a violent altercation is about to happen. If someone is physically harming someone, we are trained on how to intervene and de-escalate that situation, but we do not have specific training on how to forcefully restrain someone like a chokehold or warrior training.
We're going to move on to Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're very short on time. I just want to make the point that I've seen this type of work actually function. I went on a ride along with MPD, and we went to this scene where, unfortunately, somebody had an untimely passing, and the family was understandably very upset, and they're transferring their anger to law enforcement, and this group showed up and de-escalated the situation and enabled the law enforcement and the medical examiner to do their job and retrieve the individual who had untimely passed. I know it can work. My problem with it is what's been articulated by Representative Ingen is that there's a lack of consistency, a lack of accountability. I think the whole process needs to be rethought from the ground up of how we make this have the same kind of universal standards that apply to literally every other form of official public safety. So thank you.
Thank you. Chair Mullen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that the spreadsheet came over to our side of the table, but a lot of the organizations listed aren't even the ones that received these grants. So I'm a little confused. Okay, so I'm confused, and the numbers you were saying didn't match up with what we had. I'll also note that Office of Justice Programs, they were part of the auditing process like a couple years ago, I want to say, and they were very in compliance with the things they needed to do. And they're actually a model that can be used for some of the other grant programs, I think, around the state. So I wanted to make that point. And I know they don't pay boards. They reimburse for work that's done. And then just another thing that I know Mr. Terrell mentioned, we didn't have a reporting requirement. It's public who gets this and the amounts, but we didn't put a reporting requirement in the bill. It got shifted into a different bill. And so I think that's what happened there. The letters in your packets, in addition to the testimony, there were, I think, over a dozen letters. And I know that there was some other people that wanted to testify remotely from Greater Minnesota who weren't allowed. And so I think it's just really important for everybody to take a look at all of the great work that's being done throughout our communities, throughout our state, whether that's with nonprofits, whether that's law enforcement, whether that's through victim services, probation. There's a whole variety of good work that's being done that's preventing violence in our communities, and there is no reason to defund violence prevention. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Vice Chair Witte. A couple things I will address, and I'm going to start with Chair Fletcher just because I respect him so much. Chair Fletcher, I'm going to guess by looking at the hardware that is on your undersheriff's shirt there that he didn't start in 2013 or 2023. He's been around a little bit. And I'm going to guess he is where he is at is because you made a commitment a long time ago with department finances. You mentioned that he was an explorer, strong advocate of the Explorer program. That has nothing to do with this bill. He is not here because of this bill. The other deputy that you talked about is not here because of this bill. They're here because you support that community and you have made those inroads. So thank you for doing that. That has nothing to do with this bill. What we got going was I started looking at this funding that was going out, and what tweaked my attention was the very first organization that received $200,000 on this grant. So I looked on the form, and I'm not going to say what the agency is because I haven't done a ton of it, but I pulled up the 990. The amount of our grant, $200,000, doesn't even cover the salary of the executive director. And this agency, and this particular agency is a multi-million dollar grant agency. They are receiving, off the top of my head, I think it's $5 to $7 million. I think they've got $5 million grants that they get every year. They've got a bunch of money on hand. They've got a bunch of individuals. Some of these agencies are making, have 4 to 5 people on their salary, on their boards that are making more than the governor. We've got people that are in charge of domestic abuse advocacy centers that are making over $200,000 a year, and they're getting multiple funding from multiple accounts. So that made me say, hold on, wait a minute, what's going on here? And I dug deeper, and I looked, and I saw that the Roseville Police Department gets $301,000. Well, great, Roseville Police Department gets $301,000. That must go to a public safety, it must go to law enforcement, crime prevention. I read the grant. Grant funds provided to the city of Roseville, reducing barriers and increasing housing stability for persons in community experiencing homelessness or unsafe housing. Well, yeah, I absolutely want to do everything that we can to fight homelessness. We've got, in the last session, we had a whole committee that was nothing but homelessness. We put out millions and millions of dollars to homelessness, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't do everything we can to help eliminate homelessness. That's not part of the public safety budget. We're doing the public safety omnibus budget right now. Right now. We don't have a bill to increase any funding. We are scrapping for every cent we can. We're fighting over every bone, and we're putting out thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars, rounded up, $14 million a year is going out. For every program that you read in here, and there are some great sounding programs, after school programs, so kids on the north side don't have to walk home to an empty house. After school programs, absolutely. I'd be the first person to say, give them their $70,000, give them their $80,000. Because you know the person that's running that? Some of those are making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. That's what we expected when the testimony for this bill came 2 years ago. What we get is not even covering the salary of the top executive of some of these firms that are coming out. I'd sit down, and if I could, I'd go over every line. We can't do that right now until we get it all back and find out where it's going and make sure it's going to the right place. Sheriff Fletcher, in the past, I've talked to him, and this would be much better if it goes through the local law enforcement agency to whatever community organizations they think it is, so that it would have some valid local impact. We can't do that if we spend it first. So I'd like to pull it back, really evaluate where it's going. Some of these grants, when you look into them, they sound like they are a comedy routine for impromptu comedy. I'm going to give you a word, and you have to somehow use it in a sentence, and that's how they throw it in the grant. You come up with a sentence for your grant application that says, underwater basket weaving will help public safety, and you get money. With all of the letters, with respect to what Chair Moeller said about the dozens of letters that were solicited and the testifiers that came here live, I don't have a list of people that didn't get a grant, so I can't reach out to the people that didn't get a grant and say, please come testify because I want to pull this money and make sure that your tax money is responsibly spent. We received the solicitation for letters. Several of the people that are on the grant let us know that the solicitation by email for testimony and letters was sent out. We want good things to be done with money. We want responsible spending of money. If it's something that's going to help a kid not get into crime, we're absolutely for that. We're not going to stop that. But we want it to be done responsibly. We want good things to happen with money. And with that, thank you for your time, Chair.
House File 2532 is laid over. The last bill on our agenda is House File 2875. Chair Nash, please come to the testifier table with your testifier.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Chair Nash, I will move House File 2875 before the committee. Please begin your testimony and have your testifier identify herself for the record and give her testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. 2875 seeks to change or add four words and two commas to statute. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start over again. 2875 seeks to put four words and two commas into statute relative to the crime of stealing something like copper, and what it would be adding would be broadband services and cable services to the statute. I guarantee you this will be the least controversial bill that you've heard today, and I will allow my testifier to offer testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairs and Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 2875. For the record, my name is Melissa Wolf, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. I also want to thank Representative Nash and his co-authors, Representative Elkins, Representative Scott, and Representative Feist for their leadership on this bill. The bill in front of you makes a very brief and simple change to Minnesota Statute 609.593 by clarifying that the crime of damage or theft to telecommunications equipment includes broadband and cable services. As you all know, America's communications networks are essential components of daily life, from public safety to national security to transportation, finance, law enforcement, healthcare, education, and more. Our nation's communications infrastructure plays a critical role in the functioning of our society. A thief can easily mistake fiber-shielded inside conduit for copper and just start cutting. Consequently, they cut lines providing 911, phone, and internet services, risking access to life-saving emergency services, not to mention internet service to homes and businesses. Copper theft continues to be a significant problem in Minnesota. To highlight a few examples, the Star Tribune reported on February 23rd that a former employee of the city of Eagan was charged with stealing $4,000 in copper wire from the city last year, and two men caused more than $10,000 in damage while stealing copper wire from a communications tower outside Little Falls. Additionally, although St. Paul Cruz found a way to prevent the repeated theft of copper from lights last year, residents with landline phones lost 911 service when thieves stole utility lines. The legislature has routinely acted to pass clear and meaningful laws to protect communications infrastructure. Our current statutes separate chapters for telecommunications and for cable and broadband. The phrasing in the current statute is that these materials are used for telecommunications services. House File 2875 would make the statute clear that vandalism to broadband and cable services are unequivocally prohibited under Minnesota Statute 609.593. This straightforward update gives the public and industry assurances that all communications infrastructure, technologies, and their uses are captured and protected under the law. We appreciate your efforts on this issue over the last 18 years. The original law was originally passed in 2007, and we once again ask for your support and help to provide clarity and assurance in our statutes, giving law enforcement and prosecutors the tools to enforce these laws and stop copper thefts and fiber cuts to the best of their abilities. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Chair Nash or his testifiers? Chair Feist.
Thanks. I just wanted to say this is a good bill. I'm a co-author, as you mentioned, and it provides good clarity in the law. So thanks for bringing it.
Any other questions? Chair Mueller? Closing remarks, Chair Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to lay on the record Jim Nash bringing clarity to statute. We can all celebrate that, but just wanted to thank my co-authors and for the committee's indulgence. This is a very good solution to a real world problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
House File 2875 is laid over. There being no more business before the committee today, this meeting is adjourned.